Hi, this is Perry, and you're listening to the Chemist Corner podcast for Wednesday, November 23rd, 2011. Welcome to Chemist Corner. I'm your host, Perry Romanowski, a cosmetic science blogger dedicated to the idea of turning cosmetic chemists into formulating artists. Chemist Corner is a podcast about cosmetic science and is broadcast to help educate, entertain, and inspire current and future cosmetic scientists. The information and opinions discussed on Chemist Corner are those of the hosts and the guests alone. They do not necessarily reflect those of any past, present, or future employers. Hello, everyone! Look at this, our 23rd podcast episode published on the 23rd day of the month. Coincidence? Well, probably, yeah. I do like the number 23, though. It's a prime number. We've got a great show today with a review of a few cosmetic industry news stories and an interview with veteran cosmetic chemist Chris Boone. He'll be here to talk about how he started in this industry and made his way from a supplier to finished goods manufacturer back to the supplier world. He has insight from most of the jobs that a cosmetic chemist will have to do. But before we get to the interview, let's take a look at some chemical reactions that are used in the cosmetic industry. In college, most chemistry classes were focused on creating chemical reactions. We were constantly challenged to figure out what reaction would happen when you mix certain chemicals together. So you might find it surprising that cosmetic scientists usually do the opposite. We mix chemicals together and hope that nothing happens. In a cosmetic formula, chemical reactions are actually bad, or usually bad. They are a sign of instability, and we do everything we can to prevent them. This drive to make non-reactive systems might lead you to wonder whether all those chemical reactions you memorized in organic chemistry were a waste of time. And if you work as a cosmetic formulator, you might wonder, are there any chemical reactions in cosmetic science? In fact, there are! While most of the chemical reactions in our industry occur at the raw material supplier labs, there are a few cosmetic products specifically designed to chemically react. Here's some of the most common ones. Permanent waves. These products are designed to permanently change the shape of hair. People with straight hair often use permanent waves to get a little curl or wave in their hair. A permanent wave formula has a reducing agent like thioglycolic acid that reacts with the disulfide bonds in the cysteine amino acids, breaking down the hair structure. So hair is first shaped into curlers, then the product is put on the hair. This begins reducing the hair bonds, and when it's rinsed to stop the reaction. A neutralizing chemical like hydrogen peroxide is then added, which reforms the disulfide bonds into the new configuration. So there you have it, some actual chemistry going on the hair. Hair relaxers are actually another type of chemical reaction that we do. These products actually do the opposite of what permanent waves do. They make curly hair permanently straight. The method is similar in as that you break hair down chemically, you reshape it, and then reform the protein bond in a new configuration. Sometimes ammonium thioglycate is used, but most often sodium hydroxide or lithium hydroxide work. The compounds break down the disulfide bonds in the hair, and the neutralizing step stops the reaction. Incidentally, this is the most damaging chemical treatment for hair. Hair bleach is another chemical reaction that you see, and it's a process to turn brunettes into blondes. You didn't really think there were that many blondes in the world, did you? Hair bleach is a chemical reaction between melanin, the material that gives hair color, and hydrogen peroxide. Hair colors are more chemical reactions, so hair coloring is a slightly more complicated version of bleach. It uses hydrogen peroxide to break down the hair's natural color. Then the peroxide also oxidizes polymeric reactions with dye monomers. When the dye polymerizes inside the hair shaft, it creates a color molecule that is just too big to easily come back out. Not all of the chemical reactions are on the hair, although a lot of them are because hair is dead, and so you can create things that are a little safer. But skin darkening is a reaction. These products are designed to give fair-skinned people a tanned look. They work by using an ingredient called dihydroxyacetone, or DHA. It reacts with the proteins in the stratum corneum, the outer layer of the skin, via the Maillard reaction to produce the brown, although sometimes orange color. All the steps haven't been worked out, but basically, when DHA is exposed to skin protein, it is converted to pyruvaldehyde, which then reacts with arginine, lysine, and histidine amino acids in skin to form pigments called melanoidins. We've previously written about DHA on this blog, so take a look in the search function to find that article. The last chemical reaction we'll talk about are depilatories. These are products designed to help remove unwanted hair. The primary active in these types of cosmetics is some version of thioglycolic acid. The acid reacts with the cysteine amino acids in hair, just like in hair relaxers, and breaks down the sulfur-sulfur linkages. The hair is then reduced to a jelly-like mass that then can be wiped away. Chemical reactions are not the primary focus of most cosmetics, but there are a few reactions, so don't fret. Memorizing those reactions in organic chemistry wasn't a complete waste of time if you're a cosmetic chemist.
Chris Boone is a forward-thinking chemist who specializes in solving problems in areas of formulation, product development, and innovation. He spent time working for large companies like Unilever and Alberto Kopler as a formulator, and also worked on the supplier side at McIntyre Chemical. Currently, he is a technical service specialist at Nexio Solutions. Welcome to the program, Chris.
Thank you. It's good to be here in the Chemist Corner Studios.
Yeah, it's a luxurious Chemist Corner Studios.
Yeah.
So, Chris, I want to have you on the show because, you know, I've known you for a long time, and I know you've been in the industry and you're an interesting cosmetic chemist. So how did you get started in the cosmetic industry?
Well, it's just kind of by luck or not luck, if you way you think about it, but I actually just graduated college, and I was living with my parents, and you know they were very anxious for me to get a job and probably leave the house. So,
right.
So I, as many people did, I don't think the job market was too well when I started.
Now just to back up and say, yeah. What kind of degree did you get when you were in college?
Oh, I got a chemistry degree. I went to Southern Illinois University.
Right.
So a bachelor's in chemistry. They were anxious for me to get a job quickly, so I just went for a temp agency, as most people do at the beginning of their careers, and I just happened to get assigned at Helene Curtis, which is now Unilever. And I worked in the QC lab there, so that was kind of my entry into the whole thing, and I kind of liked what it was all about. And I mean, just doing some basic stuff at first, like just pH viscosities, and you know, matching colors, stuff like that. But it was interesting enough to want to continue with it.
All right, in a QC lab, you test the finished products, or you test raw materials, or you test everything?
It was mostly finished product, but for like when we would get in these big bulk tank wagons, they'd want to test samples from those. So like of the main surfactants that are used in shampoos and stuff, they'd test those as well.
Was it like a physically demanding job?
Not really, no. No heavy lifting.
You had people to get the...
Yeah. There's people that that actually went out to the tank wagons and got the samples.
Because I remember when I started at Alberto Kopler, because we started probably in the industry just around the same time. We had the chemists had to go physically get these 55-gallon drums and pour off samples.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a little bit more than we had to do.
Right. So you were in QC for a while as a temp. Did they eventually hire you on?
It was kind of a funny story because I got an offer at McIntyre Group, which is my next job, in their QC lab. And maybe about 2 weeks after I started, I got a call, and they wanted to hire me at Helene Curtis full time. So I had to turn that down because it was just bad timing. So, and it, you know, turned out to be
which one
thing.
You turned down the Helene Curtis?
Helene Curtis,
oh,
yeah.
Okay.
So it turned out to be a good thing. They were bought out by Unilever shortly after.
Right,
so.
A lot of those people lost their jobs.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
So then you moved to McIntyre, and you were there for a while. What kind of things did you do there?
McIntyre, so I started on a QC lab, and QC at a raw material supplier is a little bit different because you actually have to calculate, you do organic chemistry basically, so you're calculating additions to make based on mole ratios, that kind of thing. So it was a little more actually using my degree to a certain extent.
You actually had to do some math.
Yeah, you had to do some math. Right. There's a little bit of math at Lee Curtis, but not too much. And so I spent a year in QC, and then after that moved into the R&D side. I was basically one of two people at the time. It was a really small company when I started. So
So at a supplier in the R&D section, what kind of things are you doing?
You're basically doing organic synthesis, so you're making new molecules. I mean, you're not creating any new kind of syntheses or new brand new to the world molecules, but maybe making tweaks to existing molecules, like maybe changing just the fatty alcohol or, you know, the fatty portion of the molecules.
So it's the kind of stuff you learned in, say, organic chemistry?
Yeah, certainly. So that's real heavy organic chemistry at that point.
And then you left McIntyre?
Yeah, I left McIntyre. I was doing a little bit of formulating, too, before I left McIntyre, so as far as just helping people with finished formulation, so that's what kind of led me into going into... I went to Alberto Culver after that and worked in the skincare group for the first year.
At a supplier, the formulating jobs, those are mostly tech services people? Is that what they...
Yeah, it's like they basically call it applications. So they're taking their raw materials, putting them in finished formulations, and kind of peddling those to the sales team so people will use your products in final formulations.
That led you to Alberto, where you...
where it started in skincare. So I mostly did body washes, so that was where my expertise is in surfactants. Just so I spent a year, so basically kind of one product cycle for the way that company works. So, and after that, I moved on to the hair care team. So I worked on Tresemme and VO5 at the time. Spent about 5 years there, and this is when Tresemme was doing a lot of growth at the time. Yeah. So there's a lot going on. The amount of formulas was enormous. I think when I left, there was globally like 400 formulas for Tresemme or something like that. So it was a big...
As the formulator, but you were... Not only did you were doing formulas, but you had to interact with marketing and things?
Yeah, so this is when you kind of get into the whole part of not just having something to make for a customer where you're actually looking at what the consumer wants and going to a lot of focus groups and learning about, you know, women's habits and what they like and don't like. So that got to be really interesting. So I really like that part of the job.
And then from there, I guess you moved into the innovation area.
Yes. The last 2 years in Alberto, or two and a half, I was in the innovation group. So this was looking at kind of what are the next technologies that we can launch maybe 3 years from now. They're going to be the newest, latest, greatest, and, you know, new to the world kind of technologies. And I know you're also familiar with that as well.
Oh, yeah.
Having worked the same...
You actually took the job that I left.
That's right. That is correct.
That's
so,
right.
Yeah, it was really exciting. And even beyond, like, after you left, we tried to form these really strong ties with certain companies that could provide innovation to us first, so we would have some chance to launch things before anyone else.
Yeah, so that gave you an opportunity to see a lot of the, I don't know, the future technologies out there. How do you think that cosmetics might change in the future? You see anything that really is kind of interesting?
I mean, you see a lot of interesting things in the areas that you see them is maybe they're kind of getting into that drug world. So I think
like
there's
cosmeceuticals.
So it's kind of interesting. I don't know how they're going to actually be launched, but I mean, there's a lot of products out there that you can see, like they affect the way hair grows, or that's the claims right now. Mm-hmm. So, so maybe you can, instead of growing gray hair, you can get your pigment back, and or the size of the follicle, or there's a lot of actives out there that are claiming these type of properties. So I think that's one of them. The other I see is kind of in the natural area. There's things
that
going.
Seems to be a big trend.
Yeah, it's a big trend, but I think it's going to be really slow to move, because until you get a surfactant that's as cheap as sodium lauryl sulfate, that's all natural and works as well, I don't think the big guys are going to move to that.
Right.
So you're seeing it, I think, at some smaller companies. And, well, and certainly L'Oreal's moving away from it, too, with certain lines. I think that's not the bulk of
Yeah, not the bulk of their products, right. For sure. But they're experimenting. I mean, that's what everyone's doing, I guess. Now, one of the things that is an important part of a cosmetic chemist job is to come up with new product ideas. And so when you had to do that, what were some of your favorite resources for innovation, for example? Who'd you follow, or are there books or things that you found interesting?
Yeah, there's quite a few. I had a whole list of innovation blogs I'd follow. One of my favorites is probably the Chuck Fry innovationtools.com is a good one.
Yeah, I like that. I like that website.
Yeah, because it's specific to chemistry, personal care, so really has some good articles there. And then, of course, I read a lot of Seth Godin. So
the marketing new product innovation guy.
Right. And
so he had what? Well, the Purple Cow is a big one.
Yeah, that was a big one.
And then just he had the Tribes. He just had that one, and Outliers.
No, that was
Malcolm Gladwell.
Malcolm Gladwell. Yeah, who I also read.
And right. Another
very good author. So, and then probably I read the Clayton Christensen books. There was Innovator's Dilemma.
Oh yeah, Innovator's Dilemma. Yeah,
and Innovator's Solution. Those are real good to just get an idea about innovation in general and how not to innovate yourself out of a job.
But innovation continues to be a challenge at big companies. Mm-hmm. At least I found, it was just tough to convince management to try something really new or really off the board.
I think everyone talks about risk-taking, but I don't think if you want to make it in the high up in the company, you can't fail.
Right.
So,
and innovation is about failing a lot.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's the problem with a lot of the bigger companies. And also, what I also found was, like, instead of actually going out when I was on the innovation side and finding new innovation, I spent a lot more time actually talking about how I was going to do that, making PowerPoints and such. And it just doesn't get the job done. I don't think anyone's making money making PowerPoints except people that tell people how to make PowerPoints.
Right. So it's very good for the consulting world.
Yeah, exactly. So,
well, thanks for coming in, Chris. We appreciate hearing a kind of a different aspect of somebody's career in cosmetic chemistry.
Wow. Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
All right, since we have Chris here in the Chemist Corner Studios, the fine studios, hey, it's natural lighting.
Yeah,
thought we'd get beautiful. His take on some of the cosmetic science stories that are in the news. So, Chris, have you seen the Clarisonic device? That's that one there.
Yes, I'm holding it. In fact.
So that's Clarisonic is a it was created by the people who invented the Sonic toothbrush.
Okay.
The researcher guys out of that, because they gave a talk at the latest SEC meeting. And it turns out that company was just acquired by L'Oreal.
Oh, okay.
It seems like an interesting move, but do you think this is sort of a signal that big brands are moving to devices, selling devices beyond just cosmetics anymore?
Yeah, I think definitely there's going to be other things like this coming up in the future. I mean, I can't think of anything specifically, but I know there's been moves by like P&G, to also do the same thing. So
yeah, I'm a little surprised P&G didn't buy those guys up, because as far as a skin brand goes, what does L'Oreal have? So maybe this is their entree to get into skin. I mean, L'Oreal's got a lot of makeup,
right?
And they have a lot of hair. I can't
with
think
the care
really
stuff. Yeah,
at least in the United States, they don't have a really big skin brand.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, so that's an interesting the Clarisonic. Interesting device there. The thing about that thing is it really wash your face better than, like, just your hands? I mean, it probably does, right?
I guess. These bristles are very fine, so maybe they somehow can get into pores better. I don't know.
Now, do you think as a cosmetic chemist you'd need to reformulate your cleanser to work well with that?
And what I'd say is probably you wouldn't need as much foam because I think this would create a ton of foam because there's a lot of agitation that this creates. So
it does.
Yeah.
That's very, it's an interesting thing. Doesn't bode well for the scrubs, right? The facial scrubs, like...
The
St. Ives walnut scrubs.
Yeah, exactly. If you have this, you probably don't need
that
stuff in the formula.
Well, you know, companies are buying companies all the time in our industry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, speaking of companies buying ones, I saw this story about older men prefer stronger scents. It turns out as guys get older, they just their cologne or whatever, they pick stronger smelling scents.
Okay.
And I'm trying to think. That doesn't seem true to me, right?
I don't know.
I guess if you think about it, old guys are always coating themselves in cologne.
Yeah,
right?
I'm not hanging out with too many old guys.
That is true. Yeah. But remember like when you were in high school or college, the guys would have those body sprays or Axe.
Oh, yeah.
Loaded up.
I mean, I just remember, like, Dirk Carr was a big one.
Right.
And that was just reeked of most guys just... really loaded up with that stuff.
Yeah.
Or Polo. Big scent.
You know, it's strange to me. Like, I would think as guys got older, they would start to care less and less, and they would just not use anything, right?
Yeah, I think that's been the case for me. But I do notice, though, that I think my my sense of smell is probably getting worse.
Yeah.
So maybe that's the thing, is your sense of smell just gets worse, so you can't smell it, so you're going to load up more when you get older. But...
that's a good point.
You never know.
And, you know, when you want to attract those 20-somethings.
Well, that brings us to the end of our show. Thanks so much for listening. One of the things that keeps us motivated to do this podcast is the excellent comments and feedbacks we get from everyone. It really brightens our day. Just a couple of announcements. We're still coming up on the next installment of the Complete Cosmetic Chemist series, which will be about natural and green formulating. I think coming up next week, we'll be giving out a free report to kick off the series. So be sure to sign up for the Chemist Corner email list and get your free copy when it's ready. Also, the national meeting of the Society of Cosmetic Chemists is coming up on December 8th and 9th in New York City. Unfortunately, I won't be able to attend this year, but for Cosmetic Chemist, it's really one of the premier shows in the country. There should be lots of great science and networking opportunities. Actually, look for Chris Boone, because he is going to be there. As always, please go to the Cosmetic Science Forum and participate in discussions about cosmetic chemistry. We now have over 500 members, and there are really some interesting topics being discussed. You can get there from the main website, chemistcorner.com. If you appreciate the work we do here at Chemist Corner, the best way for you to help is to follow us on Twitter, or Chemist Corner is our handle, or like us on our Facebook page. You can get there from the blog, too. Well, that's all we have. Thanks, everybody, and go make a difference.